This is Audible.
Sons of the Selenar by Graham McNeil. Read by Jonathan Keeble. I, for one, know of no sweeter sight for a man's eyes than his own country. Omarus, the blind bard of Ionia. A leader is ultimately responsible for everything. The Primarch Gilliman. Loyalist? Traitor? The distinction is irrelevant. They are all sons of the Selenar. Talab Vita 37. Prologue. Do not swear by the moon, for she changes constantly. The surface of Terra was burning. Its atmosphere glowed with the fires of unity. Storms of global war raged beneath toxic skies like the banked embers of a hearth. They bathed the lunar surface in red. Warfare had riven humanity's birthrock for as long as the Selenar could remember, the conflicts growing in scale with every passing epoch and each unchecked evolution of technology.
"War has recast the world in its image," said Heliosa 54,
the ruddy light of Terra's unification reflecting from the moulded surfaces of her chromium mask.
"It has always been thus, revered matriarch,"
spat Talab Vita 37, her multi-armed form hunched over the data light of the command console.
"It is mankind's nature to destroy."
The matriarch of the Selenar turned to her most trusted Jean Maiden, hearing the stress placed on the man of mankind.
"That is likely true," agreed Heliosa 54. "But we too are a branch of that shared root. Yes, we distill the essences of singular genetic paths in search of the perfect aspects of our species, but follow the strands of history far enough back, and we are not so different."
She felt Talab Vita 37's urge to challenge that assertion, her consciously evolved nature as a contrarian and questioner, warring with her respect for Heliosa 54's vaunted archetype.
"You disagree?"
"I would not presume to, revered matriarch. Not now."
"Of course you would. It is the archetype you iterate upon with every evolution. Speak freely."
"Very well, revered matriarch,"
said Talab Vita 37, pausing to gesture towards the grim situation unfolding in front of them.
"The Emperor's transhuman warriors are bred to wreak bloody ruin and nothing else. They are capable of nothing else. But we of the Selenar cults, by iterating upon the twin mysteries of the Helix, perform acts of devotion and creation. The gene rites of the Emperor pursue only the science of death, and it is too late for them to change their course."
"And our sciences? Do we not also craft killing engines of steel and flesh?"
"For the defense of our fiefdoms, yes,"
Talab Vita 37 conceded.
"But the Dianic rites bring us closer to the true potential of humanity. Ultimately, they will move us further from the urge to destroy."
"I hope that will one day prove to be the case,"
said Heliosa 54.
"But do not be so quick to condemn our Terran brothers. In times past, there were moments when the better angels of human nature sought to turn our species from the bloody altars of war to embrace peace."
"Such times were few and far between,"
pointed out Talab Vita 37.
"And they never lasted."
As if to reinforce her point, the curve-walled chamber at the heart of the moon shook with the impact of nearby detonations. Grey dust spilled from cracks in the ceiling. It danced in the suspensor fields surrounding Heliosa 54's floating, cursive-spined form. Fractal patterns of dust glittered in the actinic light, thrown out by the gently spinning gene looms woven into the stone walls. The pneumatubes along Heliosa 54's neck pulsed in time with her frosted breath, crafting a twisting helix at her throat.
"Why does the Emperor seek to destroy us?"
asked Talab Vita 37.
The Emperor does not seek to destroy us.
Tel Abvita 37 extended a curved talon-like fingertip, hooking a disc of new spheric light from the gloss black of the command console and lifting it up between them. A rapidly shrinking noose of red light converged on their location, a silver icon of the crescent moon. Previously muted vox channels surged with screams of the doomed and dying. The unmistakable bangs of bolter fire and shrieking plasma explosions formed a deafening cacophony of slaughter.
All available data suggests otherwise, she said. Warriors of the 7th and 16th Legions are slaughtering everything in their path. Our cults are dying as we speak.
The howls of their attackers were a screeching din that scraped the spine, feral war shouts of men born in the dark and raised on murder. Such men would accept nothing less than the complete destruction of whoever dared stand before them.
The Emperor does not seek to destroy us, repeated Helios of 54. He seeks to yoke us to his great work. Not without some justification. He hopes we fear annihilation more than servitude. His hubris requires our science, our looms, and our mysteries. He knows much, but he does not know everything.
Is that why you brought me here?
Asked Tel Abvita 37.
Is that why you still remain?
Yes. If the Emperor's killers do not find me here, they will tear Luna apart until they do. They will break me, and I will be forced to give them the Magna Mater.
Tel Abvita 37 flinched at the thought and said,
What is it you require of me?
Helios of 54 extended a dexterous needle-like hand, one whose fingertips had crafted gene sequences of such dizzying complexity that it seemed inconceivable they did not belong to some ancient creator goddess.
To forsake me, said Helios of 54.
I do not understand,
said Tel Abvita 37. Data flowed between them, coiling spirals of light bearing gene sequences, marker codes, and swathes of information so complex it made Tel Abvita 37 gasp at the density of inload.
Go below, to the ergotic vault. Sever your connections to the lunar manifold. Take the Magna Mater and vanish. I cannot divulge what I do not know. Too few of the High Priestesses remain alive to destroy the Magna Mater, so you must keep it from the Emperor. You understand?
I understand,
said Tel Abvita 37. Helios of 54 saw Tel Abvita 37's shoulders slump, the Gene Maiden already burdened by the terrible duty she had placed upon her.
And if they should eventually find me?
Then pray that he who takes the Magna Mater is a wiser soul and has greater vision than Terra's new master.
Tel Abvita 37 bowed, clasping her hands across her chest.
It shall be as you say, revered matriarch, she said. I will not fail you.
Helios of 54 did not watch her go, already beginning her mnemonic purge. Sadness touched her, as precious memories burned away in the fires of synaptic erasure. She had loved Tel Abvita 37 as a daughter, but could not allow any trace of the Gene Maiden to be found within her neural network. She turned back to the console. Barely 6 hours had passed since the sudden, shocking assault of the brute-crafted Gene Warriors from Terra. Every warfront on Luna told the same story of defeat. Her heart heavy with fear for the future, the High Matriarch of Luna opened a broad-spectrum vox channel. She knew the Emperor would hear her. She hoped his warriors would.
Call off your wolves, she begged.
Book 1. Maiden. She is a wild, tangled forest with temples and treasures concealed within. Chapter 1. A Captain Remade. Skeleton Crew. Carnager. How best should a warrior die? He had given much thought to this over the years. As a neophyte, he imagined his end would come in a terrible war against some hideous xenoform, fighting side by side with his brothers for a noble and heroic cause. His last moments would come in a battle spoken of in awe by the warriors of ages yet to pass. In the following millennia, lessons learned from his end would be taught in every academy of war, required reading for the youth of this new age. Libraries of books would be written of that bloody time. But war cares nothing for the arrogant imaginings of young men. Its teachings are bloody and indifferent. Yes, heroes are forged in the crucible of combat, and the legacies of a handful live on in the memories of those who endure. But for every hero whose deeds transcend their death, tens of thousands more have forgotten or never known at all. Their courage goes unrecorded. Their stories are never told. Nykona Sharukin was no longer a neophyte, and ever since Sabik Weyland had dragged his ruined body from the betrayal on Istvan V, he'd long known he would die in the dark, alone and unremembered. A fitting end for a warrior of the Raven Guard. How best should a warrior die? In a little over 2 minutes, he'd likely find out. Spots of light flickered like Auspex glitches on the ochre orb of Jupiter, which filled the Sisypheum's viewscreen. But they weren't glitches. They were burning weapons platforms, struck from their orbital anchors, and now dragged to destruction by the vast planet's gravity. In the foreground, pyrochemical lightning and ash storms distorted the gunmetal ellipse of Ganymede, as its vast hydrostacks burned in the fury of traitor bombardments. The solar war was raging, hot and bright, but drawing inexorably closer to terror from the outer system planets. The War Master was tightening his noose, but every minute the Loyalists kept the traitors from the throne world's glory was a victory. Dying ships blazed in Jupiter's high orbit, skeletons of blackened metal alight from within. Atomic storms raged in their wakes as millions of megatons of ship-killing ordnance detonated like distant supernovas. Not as distant as Nykona Sharukin would have liked. Swarms of torpedoes flew hot in the void. Macro shells lit up space in blinding explosions. Banks of lasers blinked in collimated lines of actinic brightness. Something detonated off the ventral axis. Sharukin had no idea what it might have been. A torpedo warhead? A ship exploding? A hunter-killer mine? 367 ships maneuvered aggressively within the Jovian engagement volume. Escorts and destroyers, mostly. At least 70 vessels of capital displacement also. Sharukin had little skill in coordinating void fights or the operation of a starship, but after the disastrous mission to Lerna 212 and the decimation of the Sisypheum's crew, he'd had to learn something of the craft. A twisting shape emerged from the screeching static, and waves of interference rippled through the holographic representation of the void brawl, huge and coming right at them. Range markers and ident tags flickered to life.
"Tumbling lunar class dead ahead!"
shouted Sharukin.
"I see it!"
replied Sabik Weyland, spliced into the Sisypheum's multiple helm controls via neuroproxy devices crafted by Freighter Thematica.
"Maneuvering now!"
Weyland sounded matter-of-fact, but Sharukin had fought beside the warrior of the Iron Hands long enough to hear the strain beneath his outward calm. The bridge deck tilted violently as the Iron Father threw the Sisypheum into a hard, rolling turn. The heavily modified strike cruiser shuddered, its hull plates buckled and up-armored bulkheads groaned in protest as the kilometers-long keel flexed. Gravity shifted with the violence of the maneuver, and proximity alarms brayed. The clashing, discordant shriek of intersecting void shields filled the bridge. Hardwired servitors, maintaining shield integrity, spasmed as electrical feedback burned them alive from within. Sharukin gagged at the smell of scorched machine oil and flesh. The unimaginable scale of the gutted Luna-class vessel filled the viewscreen. Sharukin felt himself ducking as its burning superstructure passed over them. So vast it felt like it would never end. So close he felt he could reach the other ship's bridge in one powered leap.
"Didn't even come close," said Weyland,
pulling out of the turn and leaving the doomed ship in their wake as he angled them back to the battle.
"That warning was too damn late, Sharukin,"
bellowed Ulrak Branthan, the newly resurrected captain of the Sisypheum. His voice was a hideous amalgam of ruined human vocal cords and ad hoc augmetics.
"You're supposed to be tracking the flow of this battle." Do I look like the Master of Surveyors? Snapped Sherokin.
Let's step aside and find someone who can read and damn all specs, said Branthon,
his towering form stepping down from the command podium with a booming thud of asymmetrical splay-clawed feet. The captain's body was a nightmarish fusion of flesh and machine, but it bore only a passing resemblance to the honourable chassis of the dreadnought from which its parts had been cannibalised. Rather, he was now a thing of biomechanical horror, wrought by Atesh Tarsa in a moment of madness and desperation. The ancient relic known as the Heart of Iron was enmeshed in Branthon's exposed ribs and musculature like a chromium spider, beating with a loathsomeness Sharokin could barely stomach. The spoiled meat stink of Branthon's body and the noxious chemicals keeping his rotten flesh alive reminded Sharokin of his youth, of when he would find milky, bloated bodies afloat in the deep salt pools of Lycaeus. A cyber eagle, wrought from pale steel and brass, perched at his shoulder. The Iron Hands had named it Garuda, after an ancient Medusan myth, and, like the crew of the Sisypheum, it had suffered great hurts, but yet endured. On Idris, it had taken a bolt round from the swordsman Lucius, but Thematica and Wayland had restored its mechanical life. The surveyor station was awash with flickering ghost images of the absurdly close-range battle. Wayland rolled them around the shuddering wreck of the Glory Hound, a Mars-class warship burning from bow to stern. Booming clangs echoed through the ship's superstructure. Repurposed maintenance servitors at damage control blurted screeds of binaric gibberish.
"What was that?"
demanded Branthon.
"I don't know," said Sharokin. "Suicidal bombers or fighter craft with no carrier to return to. Maybe drifting wreckage too small for the Auspex to pick up?"
"Not good enough, Raven Guard."
Sharokin bit back an angry retort as the display flared with signal bloom. Threat warnings blazed to life across the glowing surface of the slate.
"Capital vessel coming about on our rearward quarter," he called. "Oberon class, I think." "The Covenant of Truth. 17th Legion Predator ship," replied Wayland sharply. "But it's not coming for us."
Dozens of threat runes blinked to life on the viewscreen.
"How can you be sure?"
barked Branthon.
"The Cryptos," said Wayland,
pulling the Sisypheum away from the larger vessel's void wake.
"It's feeding me the Covenant's encrypted vox. Its captain is communicating with two other ships. They're moving to bracket the Europa's Wrath."
Sharokin tried to sort the conflicting Auspex returns and match what he was seeing to what Wayland was telling him.
"Are you certain?" he asked. "It looks to me like the Covenant is manoeuvring for a braking barrage across our drive."
"I don't like ships on my rear," said Branthon.
Garuda spread its wings and squawked angrily.
"It's not coming for us," insisted Wayland.
"It has a perfect firing position," said Sharokin.
"Holding course," said Wayland. "Thrown, damn you, Sabek Wayland," cried Branthon, pounding across the deck towards the Iron Father.
For an instant, Sharokin thought he was going to rip Wayland from helm control. The range counters slowed and extended. Sharokin let out a breath.
"It's pulling away."
"I told you. The Covenant is hungry to kill the Europa's Wrath."
The viewscreen erupted with light as the Covenant of Truth launched staggered broadsides into its victim. Boxed in by the barrages of two other traitor warships, the Imperial vessel was forced to endure the punishing fire flaying its shields. Torpedo boats and bomber wings flew in close to the Europa's Wrath, and wave upon wave of ordnance punched into the titanic warship's hull. Secondary boosters thrust warheads farther into the larger ship before delayed action fuses detonated them deep in its vitals. A rippling wave travelled the length of the vessel as explosions raced through its internal compartments, tearing it apart from the inside. Swirling conflagrations erupted from the Wrath's many wounds, burning white-hot with pure oxygen and the chemical fire of its blood. Sharokin felt his heart clamped by an icy fist as he watched the majestic ship die. Like the last of a species finally brought to extinction, it fought to the end, but its doom was assured. The radwash of its murder fouled every sensor return, but Sharokin saw rampant cascades of high-band atomics flaring deep in its engineerium. That could only mean one thing.
"She's going critical!" shouted Sharokin. "Get us clear, Wayland!" "Belay that!" ordered Branthon. "Get us closer!"
"What?"
shouted Sharokin.
"No! You'll kill us all!"
He took a half-step towards Branthan.
Remain at your post!
Barked the monstrous captain of the Iron Hands.
Wayland, no!
Shouted Sharrokin.
It's suicide to be anywhere near that ship!
Bring us around!
Said Branthan.
The Covenant of Truth's shields are down. Vector a course directly towards its bridge. Sharrokin, get me a firing solution right now!
Wayland, get us out of here!
Pleaded Sharrokin.
He'll kill us all for the sake of vengeance!
Branthan spun around, murderously swift for something so hulking. A powerful fist, ripped from the chassis of the fallen brother Bombastus, slammed into Sharrokin's chest. He flew backwards, twisting in the air to land in a crouched skid across the deck. Muscle memory made his hand fly to his hip, where his black-bladed gladius was sheathed. He looked up to see Garuda perched on the edge of the Auspex table, its head cocked to the side as it regarded him with its unblinking eyes. Was it just his imagination? Or did the bird shake its head? Sharrokin let out a breath as Garuda took flight and returned to Branthan's shoulder. The deck shuddered as the Sisyphium fired its prow bombardment cannon at point-blank range. The Covenant of Truth's close-in defense systems had no time to react, and the city-leveling ordnance impacted on its command deck with devastating effect. An Oberon-class battleship was a monstrously powerful ship of the line, heavily armored and bristling with weapon systems, but without shields, it was vulnerable. The Sisyphium shells punched deep into the nexus of its command center, gouging mortal wounds into its brain. Plumes of fire and blossoming clouds of molten steel vented into space. The Sisyphium flew through the expanding clouds of superheated vapor and cascades of wreckage, chased by a storm of hastily aimed lasfire and burst shells from anti-torpedo frack launches. Branthan turned from Sharrokin, Garuda once again at his shoulder.
Our turn! Bring us back around, said Branthan. I want to finish this bastard off.
It's already out of the fight, said Sharrokin.
I don't want it out of the fight, snapped Branthan. I want it dead.
The Sisyphium shuddered as Wayland put the ship into a tight corkscrewing turn to starboard. He angled the prow down to obscure their course in the blazing plasma wake of the wounded battleship.
Thematica!
Barked Wayland over the vox.
I'm going to need those reactors burning hotter.
The vox crackled with a blurt of angry binaric code before Thematica answered from the Enginarium.
I assure you, Iron Father, it is taking everything I have simply to keep the reactors from overloading and killing us all. I can do only so much, with barely a handful of menial servitors assisting me.
Do what you can, Ironrot,
said Wayland, snapping off the vox.
Nykona?
Sharrokin didn't answer. His gaze fixed on Ulrak Branthan's back. He released the breath he'd been holding, feeling a sharp pain in his ribs. He relaxed his white-knuckled grip on his gladius, understanding that he had been on the verge of unleashing lethal violence on a fellow legionary. An insane fellow legionary, yes, but one whose loyalty was still given to the Emperor.
Nykona, said Wayland, his voice calm but authoritative. I need eyes in this fight. Return to your station, brother.
Sharrokin nodded slowly and sheathed his blade. The void was burning with innumerable atomic flare storms, pulsing tsunamis of E-mag surges, and the detonation echoes of the Covenant's magazine stores. Situational awareness was next to impossible to determine. Even an Auspex savant or an officer with decades of experience would likely divine nothing from this sensory anarchy.
Coming about,
said Wayland matter-of-factly, as if announcing mundane orbital manoeuvres.
Gun deck, how long till the bombardment cannon is back online?
The pained voice of Atesh Tarsa, the salamander's apothecary, echoed through the bridge.
Newman's working on it, but it will be at least 7 minutes before the weapon is ready to fire. Every part of the reload process has to be done manually.
Wayland cut the link and said,
Broadsides it is, then.
A discordant wailing cut over the voxbands, and Sharrokin winced at the torment he heard in the nightmarish howls, part binaric code, part demonic cant. In its purest form, the Mechanicum called it scrap code. It was the Kryptos, screaming from its below-deck cell. Not a warning, a shriek of terror.
Brace! Brace! Brace!
Yelled Wayland. Sharrokin saw it a second later. A tapered brow, knifing through the void, vectoring in at the perfect kill angle, murder torpedoes already loose, stabbing lasers, stripping away the last of the Sisyphium shields. The ship screamed over the vox, tearing through the Sisyphium security protocols with the visceral trauma of its name.
Carnager! Carnager! Carnager!
White-hot beams of light seared through the strike cruiser's many decks, the relative movement of the two vessels causing them to whipsaw through its reinforced superstructure. Hundreds of meters of hull plate peeled away, like meat pared from the bone by a butcher's knife. The force of entire sections venting explosively into hard vacuum heeled the ship over like a pugilist rocked back on their heels. The Auspex screamed with incoming ordnance. The blood-red light of a mortal wound filled the bridge. It painted Branthon in a demonic glow.
"You've killed us all," hissed Sharokin.
Then the world turned inside out, and red light turned to white.
Chapter 2. The Way is Open. Echoes of the Past. Back from the Dead. A frozen moment of time. It stretched, soundless and serene. Sharokin's first thought was that if this was death, then everything the old timers on Lycaeus had told him as a rebel youth was wrong. They'd spoken of death as a fire that consumed you. It would be painful, they said. Death was always painful in the old timers' tales, and it was never easy. A good death would be sudden, and if you were lucky, one you wouldn't see coming. But this moment, this eternal moment, was peaceful. Which told Sharokin it wasn't death. This was something else. Cold and weightless, Sharokin's gut swelled with nausea, like the worst translation sickness imaginable. His eyes burned, as if microscopic needles were slowly pushing into his pupils. He saw nothing but blinding, searing light. His senses swam in and out of coherence, screaming voices, cries of horror, unbridled joy. These were not voices he knew, for there were men, women, and children who screamed names he'd never heard. 1,000 voices, tens of thousands. He recognized languages of terror, as well as dialects that had only taken root in the centuries since humanity first set sail from its birth world. Woven within them were words never meant to be given voice, demonic chatterings of razor teeth and loathsome appetites. Sharokin's mouth tasted metal, and his skull bloated with a raging storm of emotions, only a few of which were his. Fear, guilt, hoped-for redemption, and overwhelming horror that was only kept from turning into a raging storm of self-destruction by iron discipline. Too much. Too fast. He felt the synapses within his mind coming untethered, the torrent of emotions eroding them like a surge tide that rips away the supports of a bridge. The empty white of his vision cleared, and once again he saw the cold steel of buttressed gantries and the riveted steel plates of the ship's bridge. The Sisypheum spun like a leaf on the wind, and an awful sense of vertigo permeated every fibre of Sharokin's being. From his marrow to his psyche, he felt as though he were folding inside out, as if every dimension of his existence were now revealed to be a flimsy construct. No sirens blared, and only the warning hiss of static filled the bridge, like the droning of carrion flies swarming the meat of the battle-fallen. Light flickered at the corner of his vision, and he rolled onto his side, closing his eyes as a fresh stab of nausea ripped up through his stomach. The sensation was so unnatural to his transhuman physiology that he almost didn't recognize it. The feeling passed, and Sharokin gripped the edge of the nearest console to pull himself upright, feeling as weak as a newborn. He blinked away the last of the burning pain in his vision, seeing the rest of the bridge crew recovering from whatever had just happened.
"Wayland, what in Medusa's name was that?"
demanded Branthon. His mechanized body drooling coolant fluids and crackling with what looked like warp corpuscent. Garuda lay on the ground, its legs twitching and its eyes flickering with machine light. Sabek didn't answer, his eyes wide and his lips moving soundlessly, like a servitor in the midst of a mind wipe. Strapped to his command throne, Sabek hadn't fallen like the rest of them, but integrated with the rest of the Sisyphean systems, he'd felt everything the ship had suffered.
"What was that?" repeated Branthon.
Sharokin wanted to check his friend, but knew he had to deal with the most pressing demand before moving to the next. Prioritize and execute. The surveyor array was a flaring mess of static and distortions, a jumble of signals, datum points, and navigational beacons that bore no resemblance to those in Jupiter's vicinity.
"I don't know," said Sharokin.
None of the readings on the Auspects make any sense.
Make them make sense,
ordered Branthon, as if the reality of their surroundings could be made clearer simply by force of will.
The Carnager could be ready to finish us off.
Sharokin shook his head.
No, he said. I'm not picking up any ship's signatures or engine flares in the void. We're alone out here.
Where exactly is here? We can't fight effectively if we don't know where we are.
If the few datum points I'm picking up are correct, then it looks like...
Like what?
Said Branthon when Sharokin didn't continue.
Like we made a warp jump, he said,
trying to make sense of what little information he could confirm.
Everything I'm seeing suggests we're no longer in the Jovian battle space. We're somewhere above the solar disk, in the outer reaches of the Transmartian Void. Roughly a third of an AU from Terra.
That's impossible,
snapped Branthon.
A warp jump this close to the sun would have torn us apart.
I don't know how else to explain it,
said Sharokin, his words growing more confident as fresh information confirmed his hypothesis.
He's right, Captain,
said Wayland, his words slurred with system shock.
I felt a huge spike in warp spectra right after the Carnager hit us. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was somewhere in the vicinity of the Comet Shrine, similar to what I'd expect to see when a warfleet translates, but many orders of magnitude larger.
The warp rift! This deep in the solar system, how?
Said Branthon. And every one of them knew there could be only one architect of such a traumatic wound in reality.
Horus Lupercal, said Sharokin.
That's how he's going to do it. How he was always going to do it,
said Wayland, unable to conceal a fleeting admiration for the sheer audacity of so bold a plan's execution.
The fighting around the Chthonic and Elysian gates was just to spread out our defences along the solar perimeter. We assumed the gates were the only way Horus could bring his fleets through. But if the scale of these readings is even vaguely accurate, then the traitors could sail 100 fleets through that rift, practically into Terra's orbit.
So we have a new target,
said Branthon.
A new target, said Sharokin, struggling to contain his anger. We're dead in the void. The Carnager's lasers all but disemboweled us. Every deck below the waterline is compromised. Our drive is offline, and one of the reactors is venting radiation into space like a damn signal flare.
Then we find somewhere to repair,
said Branthon.
Where? Said Sharokin. There's nothing out here.
An old way station, an abandoned graving yard, a lost research post, something,
said Branthon.
There must be relics of the first push from Terra drifting out here.
I'm telling you there's nothing, repeated Sharokin.
Wayland twisted in his grav couch and fixed Sharokin with a piercing stare.
Nykona,
he said, holding Sharokin's gaze.
If there is one man I would trust to find something lost in the darkness, it is you. Find us somewhere to heal the hurts done to the Sisyphean, and we will live to fight on. What is it your brothers say? From the darkness we strike, fast and lethal, and by the time our foes can react...
Sharokin grinned.
Darkness there, and nothing more.
It took Sharokin 25 hours to locate somewhere viable for the Sisyphean to effect repairs. Anchored in the void, and all but invisible, it was a nameless hollow cavern of iron, with only rudimentary docking facilities and fractional life support. In the earliest days of warships traversing the oceans of old Earth, such places were known as coaling stations, ports that allowed the navies of the great powers to extend the range and influence of their fleets. This structure had been designed to allow the first monitor ships to remain on station for extended patrol circuits of the inner system gulfs. With old Earth isolated for millennia, and many of the outer reaches of the solar system in the hands of Xenos, the thin line keeping Terra safe while the Emperor assembled his forces was only maintained by the bravery of its frontier fleets and refueling stations such as this. The search for a safe haven had also revealed more about the traumatic warp event that had ripped the fabric of the solar system asunder.
With every passing moment, the scale of the armada passing through the rift opened close to Terra became horrifyingly apparent. Fleets of such size as had not been seen since the earliest days of the Imperium were translating into real space in an unending flood. Prodigal sons now returned to the system of their birth, with blades bared for the sole purpose of murdering their sire. Bombs would already be falling on Terra, but the Sisypheum could do nothing to help. With the Iron Hands and their monotasked servitors engaged in the repair efforts to the Sisypheum, Sharakin had taken to spending his days roaming the cavernous halls of the nameless coaling station. Centuries had passed since ships had last docked here, but the titanic fueling silos still reeked of congealed promethium and the scabbed residue of volatile engine plasma. The darkness within was home to Sharakin. The interior of the Sisypheum was a gloomy place, for transhuman warriors had little need of light, and it had no serfs remaining who required illumination. Beyond the handful of space marines, only servitors prowled its lonely halls, and they cared nothing for their surroundings. But this blackness was absolute, a place where light went to die. So all-encompassing, it took Sharakin back to his training with the Shadow Masters, where he had lived for 2 years without light or vision. Terrifying to a youth, even one blooded in the darkness of Lycaeus, then bearable, before finally becoming bonded so intimately to him that he became part of it. Sharakin embraced the darkness as a reminder of simpler times. The echoes of the warships that had docked here at the dawn of the Imperium, perhaps similarly wounded, were all around him. The names of proud vessels were etched into the walls, names that sounded absurdly quaint to Sharakin. Black Joke, Divine Lip, Dexterous Gladiator, and Bittersweet Reunion. The crews of these ships had left their mark too, so many names etched over each other that they had become unreadable, tens of thousands of them, more. Sharakin understood that this was no mere utilitarian relic of a bygone age. It was a memorial to the dead, a vast record of those who had conquered the solar system. Sharakin wasn't vain enough to imagine that anyone would leave such a memorial for him, or the millions who had died in the fires of the War Master's betrayal. No, he would die in the dark, forgotten and beyond anyone's wit to recall. Assuming the Emperor's armies could defeat the traitors, this would be a war the Imperium would wish consigned to the shadows, for it would only serve as a reminder of when humanity's will had failed. Only if Terra fell to the traitors would it be celebrated as the beginning of a new age, the dawning of Lupercal Imperator's reign. He paused to run his fingers over the carvings, picturing a crewman in a bulky vac suit, likely dying of radiation poisoning, as he cut into the metal with the tip of a drill bit to secure his little piece of immortality. Centuries separated Sharakin from this long-dead crewman. But at that moment, alone, at the edge of the dark, he felt a powerful connection pass down through the ages. Sharakin set off once more, pausing every now and then when he saw a name legible enough to read. No one save he would ever read them, but it felt important that at least one person in all the galaxy remember that these men and women had existed at all. He wished he knew the name of this place, to truly mark their passing. The vox chirruped in Sharakin's ear.
"Nakona,"
said the unmistakably gruff voice of ash and smoke that belonged to Atesh Tarsa. The apothecary of the Salamander's Legion had kept them alive over the years on the bleeding edges of this conflict, and everyone aboard the Sisypheum owed him their life. But Sharakin wished Tarsa had let one of their number die.
"Where are you?"
asked the apothecary.
"In the darkness. What do you want, Atesh?"
"It's Cadmus Tyro."
"What about him?"
"He's awake, and he wants to speak to you."
The apothecarian of the Sisypheum had once been as much a place of death as the nameless coaling station. Since the massacre on the black sands of Istvan V, Ulrak Branthan had lain entombed in ice, his body a wretched conglomeration of torn meat and bone held together by sinew and pure will.
Only the Heart of Iron had kept the captain alive as he writhed in stasis, its Dark Age technologies simultaneously reweaving his flesh and blood, even as his mind annealed into the singular blade of vengeance. And there he would have remained until death, had it not been for the damn bird. For reasons known only to its inscrutable machine consciousness, Garuda had chosen to irreparably disable the stasis controls of Branthan's cryo-chamber, leaving Tarsa no option but to resort to desperate measures to save the life of his patient.
"We should have let him die,"
Sherikin had told the apothecary in the wake of the captain's rebirth.
"His thirst for vengeance will kill us all."
"If I had let him die, I would have broken my apothecary's oath,"
Tarsa had replied.
"I would have been finishing the work of the Cheetahs."
Sherikin had wanted to dispute the point, but this galaxy had seen far too much faithlessness for him to wish one more broken oath on the cosmos. He passed through the pressurized vestibule and its fog of counterseptic decontaminants. The airlock hissed closed behind him, sealing him within the sterile environment of the apothecarian. He found Tarsa hunched over a spinning centrifuge. Blood samples whirred in glass tubes, and the hum of Medicae machinery filled the space. The air tasted of tin, and the lumens flickered overhead, fizzing with poor connectivity to the ship's main grid.
"I see the power is still intermittent," said Sherikin.
Tarsa looked up, his ebon black face the opposite of the Raven Guard's pallid features. Dull red eyes were set in a craggy, hairless skull, and Sherikin saw a lifetime's sorrow in their depths. He saw Sherikin and smiled weakly.
"Nakona," he said, offering his hand. "Welcome back to the light."
Sherikin took his fellow warrior's wrist.
"I apologize, brother. I have been a stranger of late."
Tarsa nodded and said,
"The sons of the Raven Lord understand the value of solitude. It is a trait I admire. Some of our more boisterous Legion brothers prefer raucous gatherings and overt displays of brotherhood. But like you, I find such displays tiresome."
Sherikin smiled.
"There's virtue in both. I'm no hermit. But after Irene Septimus, I needed to take some time to clear my head. I needed to reevaluate my perceptions."
"You want to blame for what happened?" said Tarsa.
"I knew," said Sherikin. "I knew, and I still went along with Medusan's plan."
"Alfarius fooled us all, brother," said Tarsa. "And you were not in command."
"You should listen to him,"
said a voice from behind a surgical curtain. Tarsa parted the curtain and beckoned Sherikin through. Cadmus Tyro lay upon a steel gurney, surrounded by banks of throbbing machinery, blood pumps, autoimmune boosters, and a dozen different monitoring devices plugged directly into the weeping interfaces cut into his flesh. His wounds had been horrific, near mortal. Shattered bones, unchecked internal bleeding, mass reactive trauma, and the complete destruction of numerous organs. That he still drew breath at all was a miracle. Few could face a Primarch and live. Tarsa had employed every one of the apothecary's arts to keep him alive, but the Sisyphium's former captain had fallen into a deathly slumber, from which no one had expected him to rise. Yet, here he was, awake and clear-eyed. Sherikin's eyes roved the captain's synth-wrapped body. The wounds in his chest cavity had been packed and bound, and new flesh was filling the void. Bone splices had stimulated fresh growth, though much of the ossification of his ribs was yet to occur. Blood-stained steel rods scaffolded his legs and left arm, but even now they were being withdrawn by a pair of drifting servo skulls. The agony of the procedure was etched into Tyro's face. Like all Iron Hands, he bore pain stoically. Anything else was weakness, and Sharokin's admiration for Cadmus Tyro rose another notch.
"The blame for what happened on Irene Septimus is mine to bear," said Tyro. "For I was in command."
"I could have stopped you."
Tyro shook his head, the motion causing a visible stab of pain to spasm through him. The skulls chirruped like irritated insects at his movement.
"All this time on a 10th Legion ship, and you still don't understand us."
Sherikin bowed, conceding the point.
You're looking well, for a man Tarsus said would die, said Sharokin.
No, I said it was highly likely he would die,
clarified Tarsa.
I look like I sparred with a titan and lost,
said Tyro.
And feel worse.
You fought a Primarch, said Sharokin. That's a whole lot better than I'd expect. Tyro nodded, glancing down as another steel rod as thick as his finger was eased out of his flesh. Droplets of blood fell to the brushed steel floor before the wound sealed behind it.
Tarsa tells me. We have returned to the solar system.
Yes. What else did he tell you?
Not much beyond the fact that we are all but dead in the void, and that you found a place for us to repair.
Anything else?
Ulrak Branthon, said Tyro. He is back in command now, yes?
He is, said Sharokin.
And how is he?
Sharokin glanced at Tarsa. The apothecary had clearly skirted the issue of Branthon's madness. Sharokin had little time for diplomacy. Tyro would demand directness. But how would he react to the truth about his superior?
Branthon is insane, he said.
It took another 9 days before the Sisyphean was able to sail again. The graving dock was a titanic zero-gravity volume of heavy machinery that had taken the combined genius of Thematica and Wayland to return to functionality. Grinding lifter cranes hauled vast sheets of battered steel into place for constructor engines to weld in showers of blue sparks. Cables slaved proxy drones of ancient bulky aspect crawled across the vessel's battle-scarred hull, closing tears with web sealant and anchoring torn plating back to its superstructure. The servitors and iron hands were working wonders to repair it enough to be void-worthy. The Sisyphean would fly again, but its first serious engagement would likely tear the ship apart. Sharokin found Thematica, Newman and Wayland arguing in the shadow of the vessel's up-armoured prow. He watched them from the shadows, wreathing the gantry above the platform hung upon its battlements.
"Prow cannons! It's the only answer that makes sense,"
said Newman, his booming voice crackling over the vox.
"We need our hardest fist ready to strike."
"It'll certainly hit the hardest,"
agreed Thematica. "But the link from its firing mechanism to weapons control on the bridge is woefully degraded. It will be next to impossible to guarantee a hit unless we're at point-blank range. I assure you, Ignatius, the batteries will work best for us. A better spread of munitions, that's the way."
"Portside batteries are smashed, and the starboard capacitors are non-functional,"
grunted Newman.
"We'll get one broadside, maybe. Then we'll not shoot again. I'm telling you, the prow cannon is the weapon we need."
Wayland looked up and said,
"What do you think, Nykona?"
Sharokin looped over the gantry and pushed down to the iron decking. He landed lightly and engaged the mag clamps in his boots. He hadn't truly been trying to hide, and Sabek knew him well enough to know when he was lurking.
"Forget weapons," he said. "We don't need them anymore. Put their energy to better use."
"Typical Raven Guard,"
said Newman too loudly. The gruff veteran had lost almost all his hearing in battle against the Emperor's children, and had chosen to endure that injury until the war was over.
"What kind of warship goes into battle unarmed?"
Sharokin swept his gaze along the strike cruiser's hull. Its entire length was torn and battered, a ship desperately in need of peace. It bore its many scars proudly, like a prize fighter training for one last bout he couldn't possibly win.
"Much like us all."
"The Sisyphean's fight is done," said Sharokin. "One hard turn will break her in two."
"Then we take as many of those traitorous bastards with us as we can,"
said Newman.
"One last thrust into the War Master's heart."
"That's Branthon talking," said Sharokin.
"Captain Branthon,"
said Newman.
"You will show him respect, Raven Guard."
"No disrespect to his rank was intended," Sharokin assured him. "And you all know me enough to know that I do not fear death in battle. But we have not fought our way back from Istvan V just to throw our lives away within sight of terror."
"We can still fight," said Thematica. "There is damage we can yet do."
Sharokin shook his head.
"That's arrogance talking," he said. "You all saw the scale of the fleet that came through the rift at the Comet Shrine. Even the grandest destruction we might possibly wreak would be like spitting in the wind."
"So what are you suggesting?"
snorted Newman, his words dripping with contempt.
"That we hide? Wait until this war is decided, then limp back into the light.
Sharakin ignored the barb and said, We have fought as brothers for years, but it is over. It is time for us to return to our legions.
Captain Branthon will never allow that, said Wayland.
Captain Tyro believes it is the right answer, replied Sharakin. His words were unexpected and hit them hard in the flank, just as he'd intended.
The captain has risen from his coma, said Thematica.
Sharakin pointed to the Sisyphium. He has, and this has been his ship longer than Branthon's. The implications of Sharakin's words were so unexpectedly direct that it took the three Iron Hands a full second to realize what he was suggesting.
You dare suggest mutiny against my captain?
Raged Newman, his hand on his bolter. Branthon is a madman, said Sharakin. He will see us all dead for the sake of his madness. You all know it.
You go too far, Sharakin, said Thematica, stepping between them. You are not Iron Hands. You do not see things as we see them.
You are correct, Freyta, said Sharakin. Just as I saw them differently when Alpharius walked among us with Shadrach Medusan's face. You should have listened to me then, and you need to listen to me now. Ulrak Branthon is not fighting for any cause beyond his own vengeance. The pain has broken him, and he will damn us all in the fires of his madness. Newman wrenched his bolter free, but Wayland had seen the fury building in him and held his arm down. The veteran made a quarter turn to Wayland in furious disbelief.
You would defend these words, Samick, he demanded.
I think we should at least hear him out.
I have heard enough, snapped Newman. This is mutiny.
Tyro agrees with me, said Sharakin. As does Tarsa. And so do you, Sabic.
Is that true, Wayland? Asked Thematica.
Thematica was known for his mordant sense of humour, but Sharakin heard the tension resonating within his tone like a taut cable on the verge of snapping. Wayland heard it too and glanced up. Sharakin felt his friend's disappointment that he had forced him into this corner. But what other choice was there? Wayland released Newman's arm and took a step away.
Throne, help me. But I do, he said, though it cuts against the grain of all I have been trained to believe. The chain of command is meant to be inviolable, but the forge teaches us that when a blade is tempered, it becomes hard and brittle. To remove that brittleness, the smiter must use a careful heat before allowing his metal to cool over time. Captain Branthon's soul is fresh from the furnace of his resurrection, and if we participate in a plan of action we know to be flawed, then we are just as responsible for the consequences of its failure.
Newman slowly maglocked his bolter back to his armor and shook his head in disgust.
That it should come to this,
said the veteran with real remorse.
We face the ruin of the Imperium, and still we find ways to turn on one another.
I am not turning on you, brother, said Wayland.
You talk of usurping the captain of this vessel,
snapped Newman.
A warrior appointed by the great Ferus himself. How else can your words be interpreted?
The veteran turned and marched away. Thematica sighed.
He will go straight to Branthon.
We all should, said Wayland.
Chapter 3. Council of Traitors. Lunar Voices. Good Kill.
Cadmus Tyro walked back onto the bridge of the Sisyphium to see Ulrak Branthon standing at the captain's lectern. Two things he hadn't expected after the mission to Irene Septimus. He buried his shock at Branthon's appearance in a grimace of pain, horrified at what had become of his brother warrior. He'd caught a glimpse of him as Sharakin and Wayland hauled his broken body from the belly of the Storm Eagle. In his pain-filled delirium, he'd thought Brother Bombastus had returned, before remembering his death on the Eldar Crone World. The bridge smelled of hot metal and electricity. Servitors worked to return the various bridge stations to functionality. Data screens fizzed with static, and a tattoo of hammers on metal echoed strangely through the superstructure. Garuda flitted from the stanchions overhead, the clicking of its wings blending with the clatter of machines. Atesh Tarsa walked behind Tyro. He had told the apothecary to stay back, to not hover at his side. He couldn't be seen to return as an invalid. Ignatius Newman stood next to Branthon, with Freyta Thematica close by.
Nykona Sharakin, as always, lurked on the periphery, near the Orspec station, with Sabik Wayland seated next to helm control. The gulf between these warriors was clear. The Iron Hand stood taller and prouder at the sight of him. Regardless of what threatened their unity, he was still a captain and deserving of their respect. Tyro raised his fist and gently tapped it against his chest. He'd wanted to wear his armour to show he was returned entirely, but Tarsa had point-blank refused to allow it, and for once Tyro had acquiesced to a demand.
"Brothers," he said, "rumours of my death have been greatly exaggerated."
Wayland came forward and they clasped arms in the warrior's grip, wrist to wrist.
"Welcome back, Captain Tyro," said Wayland.
Sharakin gave him a nod of respect. Tyro stepped towards his Iron Hands brothers, reading the twin emotions of joy and wariness at his revival. Joy, for he was their captain and had led them in battle against traitors and primarchs. Wariness, because his return might be an unwitting cause of a schism within their ranks. Thematica bowed deeply and said,
"It pleases me to see you back among the living."
"Not as much as it pleases me,"
Tyro assured him, now facing Newman.
"You've healed well, Prosser," he said.
The veteran had suffered grievous wounds at the hands of Gascon Malthus, one of Alfaris's killers, but it took more than an Alpha Legionnaire to put down one of the Averni.
"The salamander knows his craft," said Newman,
managing to sound grateful and begrudging at the same time. Tyro finally turned to Ulrak Branthon. Tarsa and Sharakin had warned him of the hideous transformation wrought upon Branthon, but it was still a shock to see how profoundly the captain had changed. What had not changed was the intensity of the zeal burning behind his eyes. The monstrous captain had always been one of the Legion's most fervent adherents to the Iron Creed, but Tyro saw immediately that Sharakin had been right. There was little left of Ulrak Branthon in his brother's gaze, only a depth of madness and pain too awful to contemplate.
"I am so sorry, brother," said Tyro, "to see you like this."
"Spare me your pity," said Branthon. "I am thankful for this new chance to serve the Emperor. Pain is in my blood now. It sustains me. It empowers me."
Tyro nodded, not knowing how to answer something that sounded like a sentiment their foes might express.
"The Sisyphium's seen a hard fight," he said. "She has fought proudly, has she not?"
"You make it sound like her war is over," said Branthon.
Tyro frowned.
"Isn't it? Ironfather Wayland has apprised me of her condition. Even half the damage she has sustained would condemn her in the eyes of a shipwright assayer."
"You underestimate this ship," said Branthon,
stepping down from the command rostrum and moving from station to station with thudding iron footfalls.
"She fought her way clear of the massacre on Istvan V and sustained us through years of guerrilla warfare. She broke a traitor blockade and flew through cursed space to a lost world of the Eldar. And lastly, under my command, she took on the Iron Heart, a ship many times her size."
Branthon returned to the command lectern and stood behind it. The blatant symbolism was not lost on Tyro. "This is no longer your ship."
"While the Sisyphium yet has fight left in her, we will continue to bring death to the traitors. Do you take issue with that, or my resumption of command?"
"I take issue with neither, my captain," said Tyro. "But the Sisyphium cannot fight like this. We cannot fight like this. Look around you. 6 legionaries and a handful of servitors to crew a strike cruiser. It cannot be done."
"It has been done," said Branthon. "In the Jovian engagement, we slew the Covenant of Truth, an Oberon-class predator ship."
"I studied the battle vectors of that fight," said Tyro,
following Branthon's example and pacing from station to station.
"It was a good kill, an excellent kill, boldly made. But you was lucky, beyond belief. Had the Covenant's captain not been so obsessed with his own kill, we would all be dead."
Branthon stepped down to meet him.
"This is a war for the survival of the Imperian campus," he said. "Without boldness, we will not win. Horus will take Terra, and all we have fought and bled for will have been for nothing.
The tension thickened. Everyone on the bridge, save for the servitors, keeping utterly silent and motionless. Veils of light sparked into life, cascades of sensor data drifting like fireflies. Garbled voices scratched the air in blurts of static. Squalls of ghost binaric code faded in and out of audibility. Garuda flew down from above and landed at the edge of the console between the two captains, as though ready to arbitrate some dispute. It looked from captain to captain.
"Honor has been satisfied, Ulrich," said Tyro, keeping his voice low and even. "Look around you. Look at our ship. Look at how few of us remain. No one could say we did not do battle with all our hearts. But the time of the shattered legions is over. Our war in the shadows is done, and we must rejoin our brethren to look our enemies in the face. To do otherwise is to gainsay the word of Rogel Dorn."
"You speak for the Lord of the Seventh?"
"I presume no such thing," said Tyro. "But all the Emperor's loyal sons have heard the call to return to defend the throne world. It is time for us to heed that call, Orak. It is time for us to come in from the cold."
Branthon listened to Tyro's impassioned plea, but it was impossible to read his ravaged features. The captain remained silent for long moments, eventually turning to face Sabik Wayland.
"How long before we can be underway?"
"The Sisyphean can fly, but there are critical systems not yet fully functional. Long-range Auspex, full weapons control and Vox are all still offline."
"How long?"
Wayland glanced at Tyro. Branthon saw it and said,
"Cadmus Tyro is not the commander of this vessel. I am. Answer me."
"The reactors are still hot," said Wayland. "We can be underway as soon as the word is given."
"The word is given," said Branthon.
"Ulrich," began Tyro.
"Enough,"
snapped Branthon, towering over him.
"I am captain of this vessel, and we fight until we are dead. There is no turning away, no retreat to Terra. You think a handful of us skulking behind a wall will make more of a difference than we can with a starship? To turn and run for the imagined safety of Terra is not an honorable laying down of our burden. It is cowardice. I will not allow it, not on my ship."
A flurry of sparks erupted from the comms station behind Sabik Wayland, as if in response to Branthon's outburst. A screaming wail of howling binaric erupted from the vox horns mounted on buckled stanchions.
"Shut that off,"
said Branthon, striding over to the station and pushing the hapless servitor out of his path. The console was smashed, almost every panel removed to reveal its guts of wires and glass valves. He turned to face Wayland with a groan of hydraulics and a crackle of uninsulated cabling.
"I thought you said the Vox was inactive."
"It is,"
said Wayland, rushing to Branthon's side.
"The antenna array is smashed." "Then explain what we're hearing."
Wayland sorted through a handful of cables, found the ones he wanted and slotted them home into jacks built into the underside of his gauntlet. Thematica hurried over to the console and followed suit. The two Iron Fathers stood riveted to the spot, a pale nimbus of light surrounding their hands. The sounds of the message hissed all around them, as if carried on the air.
"It's not coming through the ship's vox," said Wayland. "Then where is it coming from?"
said Tyro.
"It's coming from the Kryptos," said Thematica. "The creature is routing it to this console."
"The Kryptos," said Tyro. "Is it picking up some stray mechanical transmissions?"
"That's not Martian code,"
said Wayland, adjusting the dials and gain levers on the smashed console.
"That's the code of Luna." "What are you talking about?" said Tyro. "Luna has fallen."
"It's coming from a native of Luna," insisted Wayland. "Only they can send in this form."
"We trained on Mars," said Thematica. "We know Mechanicum code, and that's not it."
"Then it's traitor communication," said Branthon. "The Sons of Horus have their Terran bridgehead there. They must have compromised the Selenar systems."
Wayland's face was bathed silver in the light of a helical waveform flickering on the last cracked display slate.
Wait. Is that...
said Wayland.
"Thrawn?"
"Yes, I think it is. But how..."
"What is it, Freighter?"
asked Branthon. Thematica disconnected from the console and said,
If we're right, and I suspect we are, then this is not a Mechanicum or Imperial transmission, nor is it from the traitors.
Then who is it from?
Asked Tyro.
This is a long dead channel, said Wayland. It's a Selenar cult signal.
But what is it saying?
Asked Branthon.
We don't know yet, said Wayland. But a gene witch is screaming into the void.
Atish Tarsa remembered the first time he had set eyes on the Kryptos, when Sharokin and Sabic Wayland had brought it aboard the Sisypheum. Its hideous appearance had sickened him. He had hated it. But as the years passed, he began to pity what had been done to it, living in agony, forever bound to a singular purpose for cruel masters who cared nothing for its suffering. That was no life. But were he and the crew of the Sisypheum any better? The Kryptos had not left this cell of bare iron, as much a slave to their purpose as it had been to its former masters. It sat bound to an iron throne, surrounded by banks of